We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
And good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. From time to time here on the program, we like to take advantage of the fact that people from all over come to the university to talk, and we talk about a lot of different sorts of things. And we're pleased to have here as our guest in the studio someone who is here to talk about libraries. And in fact, this is the 20th annual Mortenson Distinguished Lecture. This is sponsored by the Mortenson Center for International Library Programs. That is a center here based at the University of Illinois that connects librarians from around the world. And over the years, we've talked with a number of people who have come here at the invitation of the Mortenson Center. And we're pleased that we have as our guest this morning Dr. Shalini Aras. She is visiting here from India. She's on the faculty in the Department of Library and Information Science at the University of Mysore in Mysore, India, has been there for the last 35 years. She was a Fulbright scholar. She's been visiting professor at Virginia Tech here in the U.S. She has been involved with a project, a digital Indian digital library project, which is something that has gotten attention of people around the world, and also has led a movement in India to trying to get people who are graduate students doing advanced work, writing theses and dissertations, to do that electronically and have them available electronically so that then scholars around India and presumably any place else can have access to the work of those scholars. And she is here to give a talk, and I want to mention that that will be tomorrow at 4 o'clock in the afternoon at the Graduate School of Library and Information Science on the U of I campus, talking about shifting terrains, crossing boundaries. Digital libraries are personal and social again. And we'll talk a little bit about the role of the library and perhaps how it is returning to its roots, as not just a place for information, but also a place where people come together to talk and debate and exchange ideas. And they're really becoming social spaces again, which is something that they really were. You go a long, long way back in the history of the idea of the library. So questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. So either you're here locally, use the first one. If it's a long-distance call, use the other. And also, if you would like, you can email your question to us, will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Hi.
Tell me about the idea of the digital library, as I'm sure that some people will not be sure what exactly that means, and whether you're talking about something that is that's not a brick and mortar thing, or are you talking about something that's both the library as we think of it and something else?
Yeah, the notion and even the definitions of digital libraries vary from person to person and also to whom you are talking to, depending on the disciplinary background of those people. Because, you know, the very digital libraries field itself is essentially a merger of different fields, I would say, particularly those of the library and information sciences and also the computer sciences. So depending on whom you talk to, what is a digital library? You know, answers to that question varies, but by my take on digital libraries is those spaces which actually provide informational experiences to people. That's my definition of what digital libraries are. Mm.
And can that be a virtual space? Are you talking about a virtual space or are you talking about a physical space?
It is a virtual space. It's not a digital one. It could be a hybrid one, too, at the current scenario. But what it means is essentially, you know, whatever you are doing in a library, you are doing it in the digital way. That is, in a networked way, I would call it as.
Yeah.
Rather than virtual, I would say it's a networked space.
Yeah. And this is, I suppose, it's an outgrowth of the fact that so much information is available now in digital form. That's maybe the way that people access it, the way that people pass it back and forth, and that that has the great advantage of access, I suppose. But then there are other interesting questions also that attach to that as well.
Yeah, that's right. The amount of information that's available in digital form, it's been tremendous. It's a huge, huge amount of information. And also the increase is also huge. You know, that it is 6 times more than what it is every year. You know, today we are talking about something around the area of 280 exabytes of information that's available on the web. So naturally, the amount of information that's available on the web has increased tremendously. And not only that, the accessibility to that has also both the depth and the breadth of it has changed enormously for better. So that is what makes digital libraries a very interesting and exciting field to be working on.
Yeah. And that I'm sure that it also adds to the challenge of being a person who is in the library and information science field, is it's always been the case that people have, whether it's, I'm sure, at a big research library or whether it's at a community library, people come there, they come up to the desk, they say, this is what I need, this is what I'm looking for, can you help me? And that's always been what those people are about. Now perhaps it's a bigger challenge, I suppose, for that person behind the desk to say, okay, I can help you. I can tell you how to find it, how to find what it is that you're looking for.
I would consider that it's not a challenge anymore. Uh-huh. Because it's more an exciting time that you can not only serve, you know, people who could physically come to you or to reach out to you through the telephone, either, but you could be reaching out to anybody in the world, you know. That's what I find it very exciting. In a way, you know, it's something like the your famous Thomas Friedman's idea of this, the world is a flat one. Mm-hmm. I feel today, in terms of access to information and knowledge, it's getting flatter and better.
Yeah, tell me about this effort to get the people who are writing their masters and papers and their dissertations, getting that, not only having them do that in electronic form, but then having the results available so that people can get at it that way.
Yeah, this idea of what is commonly referred to as ETDs, electronic theses and dissertations, is again within the digital libraries domain, one of the exciting and also forefront areas, A, because of the reason that it's not only, I mean, enormously increases the accessibility factor, but more than that, especially in the context of theses and dissertations, in the print world, they were really frozen assets. So the digital world actually helps you unlock these frozen assets because, you know, they were not published materials, right? So access to the theses and dissertations was very much confined to that small community who could only visit the library as such, which was very small. So today, because it's not a published material and still you could get all these theses and dissertations accessible to one and all, that's one of the major advantages of the electronic thesis and dissertations movement. And secondly, more importantly, equally, or rather I would say equally important, is the fact that it's a new medium, a richer medium for researchers and scholars to express themselves. They need not have to be confined to the print medium. Whereas today, a scholar can express himself or herself much better, and especially particularly in some of the domains, let us say, in which are not very amenable to the print medium or even to the written medium. So they still had to, you know, do their thesis in print or rather text form. So today that's possible, and then you could give enormous rich experiences to the to the users of that thesis, and almost similar to the way that you feel. So I feel in that sense, the ETDs provide as a great medium for the scholars to articulate and express their ideas better.
Okay. Are people doing multimedia dissertations?
Yeah, they are. That's the best part of the electronic.
Really? Is there a particular example that you might give?
Yeah, there are many such examples. Like, you know, in one of these examples that we do talk about, it's, I think it's in the U.S., there was one, this, you know, a thesis on Turkish coffee houses. Okay, so, you know, this student actually, you know, used a different narrative to give that, you know, Turkish coffee house's experience and express it in his thesis. I would consider that's one of the very great examples of multimedia thesis. Yeah. And also, I mean, an exemplar of what I was talking about, like, you know, how one could express themselves better.
Yeah. Well, and I think you make the point that before, when someone wrote a thesis or wrote a dissertation, there were, I'm sure, a couple of printed copies on file somewhere. Somewhere in some library on some shelf, there was a copy of it. And then if you wanted to read that person's dissertation, well, if you could go there to the library and do it, you could. But that was sort of the problem. It sat and maybe collected dust on some shelf somewhere. And if you can now have them available electronically, that means that anybody, any place in the world, given the right tools, can read it. Is that still going to be scholars, though? Isn't that still going to be mostly scholarly readers?
Yeah, not necessarily. You know, depending on the topic, even though the material could be of a scholarly level, or the audience may be for actually scholars, but you can never say who would be interested in what kind of thesis. That's the best part of the digital libraries in general and ETDs in particular, because you could reach out to people whom you never thought would be interested in them, and also for what purpose. Let me give you an example. Just about 2 weeks back, I got a mail from someone in India saying that his grandfather wrote a book and he was trying to find that book and he didn't find it, and then he somehow found a link to his work. In my, I do a project called Vidyanidhi Digital Library, which is a digital library of electronic thesis and dissertation. So he was so excited and happy that he could find his grandfather's work in our digital library, and he wrote to me. He's not a scholar in that space, remember. He was only looking for his family, contribution, his grandfather's work. But he found it in our collection, even though it was only a reference to that article. So that's what I mean by, you don't know whom you are reaching out to. Yeah. Traditionally, you would be reaching out to, that thesis would have been, for that particular, scholars in that area. But today, it could be used for different purposes.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus is Dr. Shalini Aras. She is executive director and professor at the International School of Information Management at University of Mysore in Mysore, India, and is visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. We'll give the 20th annual Mortenson Distinguished Lecture tomorrow afternoon on the campus. It's something that's available to open and available to anybody who would like to hear what she has to say. Questions are welcome here to 333-9455 at toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Something that I'd really like to hear you talk about is this changing nature of the library, or perhaps a return to what was an older idea of what the library was for. And it's something that we, I think, increasingly are seeing at the level of the community library. And I'm assuming that to some extent this is also happening at the level of the academic research library. Talk about that.
Yeah, the idea now, in fact, if you look back in history, you will find one of the earliest libraries, whether they're the Alexandrian Library or, for example, back home in India, one of the earliest academic library was in the 4th century Nalanda Institute or Nalanda Library. Mm-hmm. They were actually places where it is not just a repository of, material, written material, but places where academic researchers would sit and, have this interaction with the books. Emphasize on this interaction part about it. Mm-hmm. It's not just about reading or accessing some material. You are interacting with the book. And not only that, those days, they were actually writing commentaries on it. There was, this idea of interaction, and your interaction actually captured in the book itself, because it would be, a book was considered like one of the, I would say, one probably a milestone in the continuum of this flow of scholarship, in one sense, because the early manuscripts in India, for example, they were all actually, a scholar would actually write the original and also with his or her own commentaries about it. That's how it would evolve. And it's my, I believe that today, in the digital world, in the digital medium, it's back in action again. Because today we are talking about these digital texts wherein you could annotate, you could write your comments. So in one sense, we are back to that, emphasizing on the interaction between the scholars, amongst the scholars, and with the written material.
Though that's something that it strikes me could go on without a library or librarian's assistance, particularly now, because all of that can happen in cyberspace. It doesn't. There needn't be a place where that happens. Is there some particular role, though, for the physical place of the library in all of this?
See, library, according to me, is not just a physical place. I would say it's a space, and it's processes. I would call a library actually a verb trapped in a noun. You know, it's an entity as a place, as in, but also a process, right?
Sure.
So you need libraries and the library processes, whether they are physical or, digital. So you would still need someone to do that. In a way, it's my take that, in a way, libraries were one of the, early outsourcing business models, if you will. Today, outsourcing is not so... it's one of the contentious issues in the U.S. particularly. What I mean by outsourcing models is, individual scholars would store their, knowledge and their information in their own heads. And then with the writing, they externalized it. And with that, this public memory increased. That's how libraries evolved as institutions. Somewhere, you could outsource. And even the processes. So it's an extension of what a scholar would do in order to interact with that information and knowledge and create and consume scholarship, I would say. So libraries and librarians or library processes are one way of when it became too much for one individual to handle, you had these institutions evolve. And it continues to be a requirement even today because you have so much more information.
Yeah.
So some processes and some agents have to facilitate this. So that's why there is still a greater need, I would say, of libraries and library processes and thereby librarians to facilitate that.
Yeah.
Because the interactions have increased now.
Yeah. Well, and certainly I know that at your level, you're interested in what happens at large academic research libraries. You know, my experience just as a library patron is a little bit different, but I can also see here, for example, in our community, we have two very fine community libraries, and there are a lot of good libraries in the surrounding communities, and they're becoming increasingly important to people in the ghost communities as places to get books, but also a lot of other things, but also as places to come for help to find information, to make your way out there in the great web of information. And I think increasingly we should expect them to be centers of community activity because it's also a place where people can come together for meetings, for events, for whatever it is. They're very, I hope people appreciate them as a very important community institutions. And if anything, the demands on the community library are growing. They're certainly not shrinking, and they're having to try to figure out how to meet increasing volume and increasing demands by patrons for all kinds of things. I think it's encouraging. I'm sure people in the library and information science field find it very encouraging that these institutions are so busy. It's a challenge for those people, I'm sure, to meet the needs of their communities. But it's a great thing to see libraries, community libraries, as thriving institutions.
That's right. In a way, I would consider that libraries, especially in the present world of this digital world, we have two distinct functions to do. One is in the digital space where you facilitate this kind of interaction. And at the same time, it is again one other thing of, going back to the essential idea of library as the place. I would call it as the happening place today. People would come and then sit there and, you create that space for people to come together physically as well and then interact. So you need a place to meet. So libraries should and would be focusing on that dimension of libraries as the physical space for a community to come. And the other important aspect of today's community information services or community centers is that with the new technologies of Web 2.0, social web, etc., the community aspect is further heightened, and then, you know, it's possible now to make it a very involved and engaged community activity. That is, the community is not just the consumers of information, but they are participating in the information process itself. Yeah. That's a great thing, I would say, and that's a great boon for the libraries too.
I know that you have done a little bit, at least a little bit of thinking and writing about e-books, electronic books. And I wonder if you have some thoughts about what that means for, you know, you talked about the fact that it's important that academic research libraries have their materials widely available. So now it's possible that if you want to read research that you can get at in an electronic mm-hmm. form. And I wonder what, though, if you have any thoughts about the particularly in the level of the community library, what it means for that institution if more and more people are going to access materials, books, and other things in an electronic form, and so then customers are going to want that rather than they're going to still want to deal with the library. They're going to want to get books from the library. But rather than the book, I guess what they're going to want is a download so that they can put it on their iPad or something and read it that way.
Yeah, and that's a distinct possibility as we move forward in time. Mm-hmm. And especially like coming from India, I would say, you know, in future, perhaps, you know, a handheld mobile device would be an all-compassing device. Mm-hmm. Because in our country especially, that's one of the, you know, technological devices that has been actually put in the hands of every common person, irrespective of whether one is a scholar, rich or poor. Because today in India, we have 600 million mobile handsets, okay? And almost everyone, if not everyone, at least every household, even if the poorest of the poor have a mobile. Mm-hmm. And then it is expected that most of these mobiles would become smartphones, which right. would provide access to the reading materials and stuff. So, in fact, already there are such endeavors in place, or you know, initiatives in place, or at least having been embarked upon, wherein they are using these mobile devices to empower people through these kinds of, if not exactly books, but at least, you know, some kind of education material, learning materials for kids in school, in rural areas who don't have access to other kinds of books.
Yeah. That, I guess, though, I maybe again now it raises some questions about libraries. If, mm-hmm. if as you say, the people are accessing a wide range of information electronically, and they can do it from their desktop, they can do it with their laptop, anywhere. And now increasingly it seems that we think what's going to happen is that more and more people are going to do that with some kind of mobile device. It's either going to be a smartphone, it's going to be a slate, touchscreen slate, it's going to be something like that that's going to be a relatively small, easily portable device. And that rather than having to plug it into a wire to get it, it's going to get it in some sort of wireless fashion. So that makes it increasingly possible for you almost wherever you are to get a very, if not anything you want, you know, a very wide range. And I guess I wonder that then again, does that suddenly plunge us back into the questions about what do we need libraries for, at least as brick and mortar institutions? And it is this yet another wrinkle in people who run libraries as they think about what kind of place do we want to be and what sort of services do we want to provide?
Yeah, to the first question of whether we would still be needing the brick and mortar libraries, I would say yes, because going back to we need to serve these two functions. You know, you need to have a physical space for people to come and do some of these activities. So that would be the library, which has been one of the, you know, such physical spaces where you would provide such kind of facilities, or even, you know, access points, or you can call them as charging points or whatever you call it as, you know, downloading points, mm-hmm. or something that facilitates that. That's one side of that. That is a brick and mortar side of the library. And then, as I mentioned earlier about the processes involved, someone has to, some profession or some community of people have to be facilitating that. right? So that's the library community, which would be facilitating those kinds of processes wherever they are. And they may not actually visit the library, which is already happening. You know, even in academic libraries nowadays, you know, most of the scholars don't really visit the library. But that doesn't mean that they're not using the library services or they're not making use of the processes. So it's more like, you know, you don't see them or physically meet them or physically visit. But then behind the screen, there are these processes happening. And there is a need for a community or a profession which facilitates that. So that's the way it is going to be in the future too. My take on this is the more and more we move towards the digital world, the more and more you need these kinds of more specialized processes, someone who facilitates that. You know, in the library world, it is kind of, to some extent, people thought that, you know, with the digital world, there is less and less of intermediation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yes and no. My answer to that is yes and no, in the sense, well, you don't see the intermediation so much. But then there is more intermediation in digital world because you need more people or more processes which do the intermediation. It's a very big disconnected world in one sense, you know. Mm-hmm. What I mean by disconnected, they're not one homogeneous cyberspace. The cyberspace consists of so many distributed spaces. And that needs to be, that is being stitched together through various technologies and processes and agents.
Yeah.
So even though it appears to be less and less of intermediation for access to information and knowledge, well, it's only, you know, what is seen are explicitly so. But behind that, actually, there is more and more of intermediation.
Well, I think, again, it gets back to the idea that on the one hand, yes, it's true that we now, through a variety of devices, have access to a stunningly wide range of information.
Mm-hmm.
That does not necessarily mean that you can find what you want easily. You may not be able to find what you want at all, but it might take a lot of work. So there still is a role for a person who understands these systems, understands how to make them work for you, and if nothing else, can save you a lot of time because you can, you, in one way or another, you can say to a person, whether you're doing that physically or in some other way, you can say, look, this is what I am looking for. Can you help me? It can mean an awful lot to have someone say, oh, sure, I can tell you how to do that and get you where you want to go and do it in a timely way.
That's right. Because, like, for example, today, many of the, let's take the example of airline booking. It can be done, online by each one of us. But still, there is that, you know, a travel agent who can do it. It's again that outsourcing. Why you want to do everything yourself, even though it's possible to do, right? So there are these specialized people who know better how to do such stuff. So they will be able to do that either upon request, or as I said, there are these, talking about finding more relevant material. So you need behind the information, you have this lot of information behind. Those information or those information resources need to be organized in because there is so much information, it needs to be organized better today. And that's where the library process is coming to play. Yeah.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Dr. Shalini Aras. She is the executive director and she's also professor at the International School of Information Management at University of Mysore in India. She's been there on faculty for 35 years. She was a Fulbright scholar and visiting professor at Virginia Tech here in the United States in 2000-2001. She's quite well known for having worked on an Indian digital library and also having led a movement in India to get to people when they write their master's thesis and their doctoral dissertation to do that electronically and then to have all this available electronically. She's visiting the campus for the 20th Annual Mortenson Distinguished Lecture. This is sponsored by the Mortenson Center for International Library Programs, and she'll be giving a talk tomorrow afternoon at 4 at the Graduate School of Library and Information Science about the changing role of libraries as they become increasingly digital and in fact how perhaps, as she has explained, the library is coming back to an earlier kind of character that maybe it had a very long time ago and is once again being a place, not just a place to access information, but a place where one way or another people come together and talk and meet and debate and share ideas it becomes much more of a kind of a social space, more than just a place where there is information that can be accessed. So questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. I think probably a lot of people hearing us will be familiar with the term digital divide, which is a term that essentially describes the fact that when it comes to access to information digitally, there are some people who have it and some people who don't. And that partly that's about whether or not you have the means. It's partly a matter of acquiring a certain kinds of literacy. And it's something people in this country certainly are concerned about. How do you close the divide? In India, how are you doing with the digital divide?
Well, I would consider that the digital divide is rather digital dividend. Mm-hmm. I would like to call it as digital dividend rather than digital divide.
Okay.
Because the dividend's for everybody. Going back to the same idea of flattening.
Yes.
See, today, these digital technologies, in general, I'm talking about, not just the digital libraries, the digital technologies, actually are closing the gap.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you may not see that in the short term immediately. It might take 1 or 2. It's taken. But already we see that even in India, that the gap is closing. So that's why I said it's a kind of a force multiplier or not a divide. It's actually a dividend that everyone can partake, not just limited to the privileged few. It's more... It might not seem so in the very beginning. You know, just as one of the best things about any technology is in the beginning, the technology seemed to be only for the rich and the privileged. But within a matter of few years, you know, all technologies become affordable and accessible to everyone. And it's so true of information and communication technologies. So in general, I would say, especially for India, I don't see it much of a digital divide because the governments and, you know, we have seen, for example, the UNDP, the Millennium, wherever, you know, everybody is talking about information literacy programs and governments have, Indian government, for example, has taken many initiatives in order to bridge this divide. In general, education and other divides plus the digital divide. For example, recently in India, we have had this universal education policy where, you know, right to education. So right to education has been passed. Now it's a fundamental right of every child to have education. Mm-hmm. So as part of it, now every child, if they don't have access to education, you know, the main impact of this right to education bill has been that now one can go to the court and say, well, I don't have access to education. That's one general framework I'm talking about, which is reducing the digital divide. Two, studies have shown, I do have data because there are many organizations which have been collecting the data regarding access to education in general. Access to education is no longer a big problem or a challenge in India. Well, the quality, it could vary. That's definitely an issue. The quality of education that is available and accessible, there is a big variance. That's true. But that quality variance in education could be minimized, is being minimized with digital technologies. Because the same kind of, you know, educational resources that's available to better schools is now made available to the, you know, poorer rural schools. And even the government of India, for example, is having many policies wherein they are actually making these, you know, computers and network connectivity, etc., available to poor rural communities. Mm-hmm. So basically, my take on this is that digital technologies are actually enablers of bridging that divide, which was there before. So that's why it's a digital dividend, I call it as. Now, they facilitate better access and they flatten the whole world within the community of, let's say, within India too.
Yeah. Yeah, I do think it's interesting how we increasingly have come to take these sort of devices and this kind of access as being just a given. We were just yesterday marveling at this article that was just published recently in the New York Times about families who had toddlers, where the toddlers discovered the iPhone and became so enamored of it that the parents could hardly pry it out of their hands. And that this wasn't something the parents hadn't given the phone to the kids. The kids just saw the phone and thought, oh, this is shining and pretty nice, and picked it up and started playing with it and were able very quickly to figure out how to make it work and how to do stuff. and we weren't exactly sure whether we thought that was a good thing or a bad thing, but, you know, maybe it is what it is, that perhaps now one will just simply take for granted that these devices will surround you and that will be the way that you will get so much media.
Yeah, that's right. You know, your example of the iPhone, reminded me of, you know, one of the series of experiments and program that is done in India called Hole in the Wall program. You know, one Dr. Sugata Mitra, he started this experimentation because he was, there is one organization called NIIT, National Institute of Information Technology, which has been spreading, you know, computer training across the country, as said. So he created this wall, just a wall which is there in any, and then created one small hole in that and kept this computer monitor there. And then let the children, you know, just play with it and figure out how to use that. And his studies show that, you know, children were so adept, as you were saying, they figured it out how to use the computer, how to access the internet, etc. So perhaps there is this intuitive, a human understanding of how to play, because after all, computers are designed by human people, human beings, so naturally, you know, there is that intuitiveness. And two, I would also say that way, that's one advantage of the technology. You know, kids are generally people, not only kids, you know, adults too. They easily are enamored by new technology, the shiny devices. So that's why it makes them, you know, it incentivizes them to use it.
We are coming into about our last 10 minutes of the program here with Dr. Shalini Aras, and she's with the International School of Information Management at University of Mysore in India. She's here on the campus visiting. We'll give the 20th annual Mortenson Distinguished Lecture. This is sponsored by the Mortenson Center for International Library Programs. That's tomorrow afternoon on the campus, and I believe that anyone who would like to hear her should feel welcome to stop by. Also, questions here on the program are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Just to shift to something completely different, recently on the program, I was talking with a Brazilian anthropologist, Roberto da Mata, who was here visiting. And we had an interesting conversation. We were talking a lot about Brazilian politics. But I sort of made this observation. I said, well, you know, we hear an awful lot about the fact that in the world today, there are particularly four booming emerging economies that are becoming more and more important, and we believe in the future will be even more important than today. And they're known by the acronym BRIC, which stands for Brazil, India, Russia, China. And I said to him, well, we know that, and yet as far as Brazil is concerned, I said, well, what really in the United States do we know about Brazil? And he said that, yes, he thought that was an issue, that even among people who study Latin America, perhaps they don't know what they should about Brazil. And he said something like, well, you know, the thing is that Russia was the old, as far as the United States is concerned, Russia was the old enemy, China's the new enemy. India, at least, seems to have a popular culture that we have some familiarity with. You know, he made the observation that in India, for example, we have very many fine writers who write in English, but that I think for a lot of reasons, I think that he would say that Brazil is still something of a blank space in the minds of a lot of Americans. So having said all that, coming to India, I wonder just what sort of thoughts you have about, you know, how people think about India, the image of India, how much they know about India. But I think for a lot of people, it's in a way kind of a blank space as well.
You mean your question is about what is the image that others have of India?
Yeah.
Well, if I go by my own personal experiences, I would say in the last 10, 15 years, I see a major difference and shift in the way, you know, outsiders, whether it is in the East, like, for example, Malaysia or China, etc., or in the West, such as Europe or U.S., they view India and Indians. I see that change, and change for better in the more positive sense. You know, they view India in a more positive sense, which is, I think, justifiable because we have made enormous progress economically. You know, there used to be this talk about what was, sarcastically called as the Hindu rate of growth, which was something like, 3.4, 0.5 growth. Now, today we are, when there is this economic recession, we are now, consistently and continuously having 8.5% growth, economic growth. And then we have reached that, it's my take, I'm not an economist, but it's my take on this is that we have reached that stage, India as a country, as a society, has reached that stage of, where it can be into, even though it's not possible, a self-perpetuating economic self-contained entity. You have reached that stage where, your product and your economy can fuel its own economy. It's not, in a way, I would consider it as, we are integrated with the world, and at the same time, we have our own, sustainable economy. That's the economic side of it. And then the other one is, both outside of India, I feel that the image of India has changed. So people know more about India than what they used to. There was a time when I had to tell, for example, I come from South India. Well, I had to say, I'm from Mysore, and, there is this place called Bangalore, which is the state of, which is the capital of Karnataka. But Bangalore, now everybody knows, including Barack Obama, he always makes, your president makes a comparison between Bangalore and Buffalo, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the kind of image that people have about India, even though it still continues to be that of a mystical, poor country. And at the same time, there is this idea of an emerging economic power.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that people don't really appreciate, and I can only say this and not being an expert, but I certainly don't appreciate that India is a very big place. There is a great deal of diversity, cultural diversity, language diversity. People listen to different kinds of music. They eat different things. They use completely different words. I mean, the people from the north, the south, the east, and the west are really very different. And that's something that I suppose that we just see it as one big space on the map.
Yeah. That's right. That understanding of India has been there. But then probably people, I feel that, the fact that India's growth has not been so great, it's mainly because, according to me, for two reasons. One is the fact that we are a democracy compared to any other country, which is in the emerging economies, compared to particularly China. So it's a lot more challenging to achieve development and economic growth along with democratic setup. And we are truly a great democracy, which I'm very proud of, and the freedom of expression and all that we have. It makes it difficult for a government to just implement anything that they want, which is a good thing in a way, but maybe to a certain extent in the short term, maybe an obstacle to the economic progress. And the second one is the diversity factor.
Yeah.
So many languages, so many groups and cultural, and also, the communal harmony is there. But what people see is only the communal clashes, because we are the only country outside of Indonesia having the largest Muslim population. So about 12 to 13% of Indians are Muslims.
Yeah.
And then we have had this, coexistence and harmonious living in our country, even though it might appear that there are so many clashes. Yes, there are. But then I would say it's like the most of the cases, it's kind of harmonious. But for the other external factors coming in, Indians, whether Hindus or Muslims, they are all in one group. Only thing is, some of these things impinge upon their thinking and ideas. So these factors, the fact that we have this diversity, particularly of even religious diversity, because no other country has this challenge of, dealing with a large, diverse Muslim population. Plus, within our own country, we have this language diversity, we have this cultural diversity. So, and also, one of the other thing is, always any old civilization has to have this baggage of the old to deal with it. It's not that easy to unlearn certain things, etc. So those are the challenges that India faces in trying to come to terms with the whole idea of economic growth.
We have a caller here to get in. So before we run out of time, let's do that. This is someone listening in Indiana nearby, okay. Line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was wondering if you could give a quick oversight of how this new change for the library system is going to affect the education of librarians. I live in best way to look at it is a county. It only has 30,000 people. And our library is going through that right now. And I've noticed very quickly that the younger people who work at the library are way ahead in the information age thing in regard to the older ladies. And I talked to one of the ladies, and she says their courses are changing now. They're taking more information courses. And I was wondering if this is going to restructure librarianship altogether in terms of education. Thanks.
All right.
Yeah, it's been going on. The restructuring of library information science education has been going on for quite some time now, across the world, including India, the United States. And one of the recent, developments in this education space is the emergence of the information schools or the iSchool movement that has happened in the U.S. And that's what, my own institution back in India, that's the International School of Information Management. So we have actually established a new program and a new institute just to restructure and reposition the whole program of educating the library information science professionals in India. To a certain extent, modeled after the information school or the iSchool movement that is happening in the U.S. And so that is one answer to that question, I would guess, because, the field of library information science has been always in a constant state of flux, which is a good thing because it's constantly evolving and redefining itself. So the redefining and the evolution of the library information science education has been going on right from the very beginning of the 20th century. And the current status is now the emergence of the iSchools across the world to meet these challenges of the internet, impact of internet and digital world. So today, the library and information science education focuses on not just the digital technologies, but also the aspect of human-computer interaction or human-information interactions. So that is the restructuring that is happening in different ways around the world.
Mm-hmm. So it's now great interest in the hardware and how it works and things like databases and how they're constructed and when where information is and how to get it, but also about how it is that people use those things and how they interface with those things and how they hopefully use the devices and the various kinds of information access points, how it is they get to whatever it is that they want.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. In fact, today that's where usability engineering, as it called, as our usability studies have increased so much. And that's one of the focus areas of research and development in the information science field. Because, the whole idea is if you build them, will they come? So to make them more than access, it's a question of use. So the focus has shifted from access because now to digital technologies enable you to provide easy access. So now the focus of attention of library information science has shifted from access to use and usability.
Yeah. I don't know, over time, and maybe it's because we're here at a university and we have this very large library and information school that we've had these conversations about these very issues. I don't know when it would have been the first time that we said we were talking about the future of the library in the digital age, but it's been a while. I mean, we've had a lot of those kind of conversations. And I guess I can imagine continuing to have that conversation. What are the are there still some big questions that you feel that you have to confront, or as you think about where you're going to be in 5 or 10 years or more, are there some particular interesting questions or problems that you think about?
Yeah, I mean, in my perspective, the interesting problems of or challenges of in the information field would be to how do you actually have information personalized and customized to the user's perspective and user's cognition. Mm-hmm. Same time, you have to have this international but at the same time local one, right? So similarly, how do you have that? That would be one of the greatest challenges for the information world. How do you make it relevant? Because relevance is something very individual.
Yeah.
So what is relevant to me may not be relevant to you. So how do you make that information relevant and pertinent to the user remains one of the great challenges. It will continue to remain, according to me, because users cannot articulate what they want. So that's the challenge I would consider as one of the main challenges of information.
Yeah. Developing search tools that know what you want, even if you're not quite sure what you want.
I suppose that's
both attractive and also a little frightening, I guess, because of what it's going to have to know about you to make those decisions.
That's right. So, usually, currently, the search engines or other interfaces that they are developing, they go by your past use, right? So they try to profile you, which, as you say, is frightening because, that would also mean it would, impinge on your privacy.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how do you, make that happen without actually, invading the privacy of people? That would be the challenge.
Our guest this morning, Dr. Shalini Otis. She is executive director and professor at the International School of Information Management, University of Mysore, India. She is here on the campus. We'll be giving the 20th annual Mortensen Distinguished Lecture talking about the changing role of the library in the digital age. That's tomorrow afternoon at 4 at the Graduate School of Library and Information Science on the campus. And anyone who's interested in attending should feel welcome. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, David. It's been wonderful. I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.